I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. For a sports writer like Joe Posnanski, it had to be a dream come true. Unprecedented access to the most revered figure in college football, Joe Paterno. 2 years spent with a legendary coach and freedom to read Paterno's notes positioned Posnanski to write the comprehensive biography of the beloved Joe Pa. Then the Sandusky scandal broke, and suddenly the ending to the Paterno story changed. Today, Joe Posnanski shares with us the experiences that resulted in a book that debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list and made Hollywood news. The writing of Paterno on Up to Date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Joe Posnanski's new book on Joe Paterno is controversial for a whole bunch of reasons. For one, the book came out as so many revelations about the sex scandal that Penn State football was facing were still settling on the public. For another, Posnanski goes beyond the controversy and tells the full story of Paterno's remarkable career, which included 409 wins, an all-time Division I record. Critics have been vicious. One writer at Salon.com calls the book disgraceful and a minor literary crime. Posnanski insists with time and with some distance from an emotional events at State College, Pennsylvania, the book will be viewed as fair. Joe Posnanski was named the best sports writer in America by the National Sports Writers and Sportscasters Hall of Fame in 2012. He's worked for the Kansas City Star and Sports Illustrated and now works as a senior writer for Sports on Earth, a joint sports writing venture of USA Today Sports Group and Major League Baseball Advanced Media. Joe, welcome back to town. So good to have you here.
It's good to be back.
Well, one of the scenes in this book that really stood out to me, Joe, was the story you recount about the Paterno family at an all-you-can-eat restaurant, and one of the coach's kids takes a cucumber off another kid's plate, and the coach goes nuts. He accuses his daughter of ripping off the restaurant, and Paterno ends up storming off in a huff. That's such a powerful story, and yet this is the same guy, the same coach, who by your own conclusion, Joe, didn't do enough to stop Jerry Sandusky. So how do you square the man who's such a stickler for details with the man who didn't do enough to stop a child sex predator?
Well, I think you've just hit at the heart of what the entire book is about. I think there's so many things in life that are complicated, and it's so difficult, I think, to paint black and white and not allow the various subtleties of life to involve. I mean, I knew when I heard that story about the restaurant. I heard it from every member of the family, by the way. It tells a certain story about a certain man, you know, and it's a man who is not just moral, but several steps above moral. I mean, obviously, who else would get that upset about a cucumber? And then yet, on the other hand, obviously late in his life, the revelations of Jerry Sandusky and the horrible crimes he committed and all of that, there were many people who could have stopped him. And Joe Paterno was certainly in that group, and living up to those high, high standards that he had set for himself, that he'd set for his players, his family, everybody around him. Obviously you have to ask questions, and that's certainly what the book does.
You know, he did tell the athletic director, but you're told in your reporting, Joe, find out why he didn't follow up, and there's the story. And so he didn't follow up in your mind because why?
Well, I think, again, now we're starting to get into trying to get inside his head.
Yeah.
What he always said was he didn't understand it. He didn't know it. He didn't understand the level of the crimes. He certainly didn't know what an evil person and how often and how many people Jerry Sandusky hurt. That is what he said to his grave, and that's what he honestly believed. And that certainly, if you believe in a certain kind of man, that was Joe Paterno for 50 years. You know, one thing I often talk about is the grand jury presentment, the one that shocked the nation, came out on November 5th on a Saturday. On November 4th, one day earlier, Joe Paterno was widely considered the favorite to win the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. I mean, we are not talking about, you know, somebody whose life had been a certain kind and then the end. You know, we're talking about somebody who had been held up as the paragon for 50 years. And then instantly people assumed the absolute worst about him. And that's that to me is trying to find the real person in the middle of that is quite a challenge.
And so you'll wonder, Joe, I mean, is this just a case of an old man who was being confronted with a situation in life that he simply didn't know very much about and maybe couldn't wrap his arms around it? Or, you know, did Mike McQuarrie, when he had this, you know, meeting with the coach and told him what he saw in the locker room, and it wasn't crystal clear, but there were certainly implications that something terrible and sexual had happened. I mean, why wasn't that enough? I mean, you sort of, again, you come back to that point.
Well, but I think you put an or in there, and there are ands instead of ors. You are talking about an older man from a different generation who was, by all accounts, a prude and somebody. I mean, that was not unknown about him. You talk about Mike McQuarrie, and I'm sure we'll talk more about him. What did Mike McQuarrie actually say to Joe Paterno?
And we don't know that.
We don't know that. And Joe Paterno was always, you know, in his comments to me and in his statements to me, I mean, he said what he told him very, very little, almost nothing. And that really what he got out of that conversation was more that he was very nervous. That it was more about the way he acted rather than what he said. And we are talking about somebody who the night of the circumstance, and just to catch people up, Mike McQuarrie was the graduate assistant, who on a Friday night returned to his locker and saw something involving Jerry Sandusky and a young boy in the shower. Later in the grand jury presentment, it would be said that he saw rape of the boy. He's always been very, very Mike McQuarrie. The witness has always been very, very sketchy,
vague,
about what he saw. Mm-hmm. And to me, one really compelling fact that has not been talked about a lot was he went home that night afterward. He was very, very upset, obviously. And he went to talk to his father. And he did not tell his father that he saw the child being molested or sexually harmed in any way. And then they called over a doctor who is a family friend, Dr. Dranoff. And Dr. Dranoff asked Mike McQuarrie three times, and I'm talking about that very night, what did you see? And Mike McQuarrie said, I saw nothing. I heard something, but I didn't see anything. The next morning, he went to talk to Joe Paterno. So now, what did he tell Joe Paterno? He's been very clear in saying that out of respect for Joe Paterno, he didn't use certain language, this, that, and the other. But we are talking about somebody who the very night of the event told a doctor, who, by the way, would have had to be a mandated reporter had he actually told him anything, told him that night he didn't see anything. So it's very, very vague. No matter how much people want to make it clear and crystal, if Joe Paterno was told what people have come to think that he was told, you have to ask a lot of different kinds of questions. But if he was told something very vague, if he was told something he didn't really understand, and his thought was, okay, well, I need to do what I'm supposed to do, and that's report this to the next person in the chain of command, it's a different question.
We're talking with Joe Poznanski about his new book on the life of Joe Paterno. And just to be crystal clear about this, Joe Paterno and Jerry Sandusky were not friends. In fact, they were enemies, to put it nicely.
At the end, they certainly were. They never liked each other from the very start. They were not friends. They were very, very different people. But for a very long time, probably 25 years, Jerry Sandusky was a very, very good coach. And even though they did not get along, even though they didn't have any social connections whatsoever, they were very they were able to work together. And we've all had that experience, I think, of working with people we don't necessarily like, but you respect what they do. In the 1990s, leading up to the 1998 incident, and then, of course, later the McQuarrie incident, when Sandusky wasn't working for him anymore, that really fell apart because Joe Paterno started believing that Jerry Sandusky was not a good coach anymore. He was not trying. He was not recruiting. He was not in any way, shape, or form helping. And, of course, they already didn't like each other from the start. So there was a concerted effort to push Jerry Sandusky out in a quiet way to reassign him, to put him in some sort of administrative role, or to get him to go to another school. And that led to the 1999 retirement that even the biggest critics and most cynical people believe had nothing to do with the incidents. So that, to me, what makes that interesting, that doesn't prove anything, okay? I mean, the fact they didn't like each other. But I did find it striking that really my book was kind of the first time. That was not unknown in State College. I mean, that is well known. And it's kind of inconvenient for some of the narrative. I mean, the narrative I read over and over again was he was protecting his friend. It was his great friend, Jerry Sandusky. And that just isn't true. That doesn't clear anybody. It doesn't make Joe Paterno any less culpable than he might have been.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those many, many, many inconvenient facts that just were kind of ignored in an effort to – I don't know what the effort was, but it was just kind of ignored.
You know, Joe, to what extent was there this sort of – I'm not sure what the adjective is, the sanctified bubble around Penn State football that created an atmosphere where people simply did not want to talk about anything that might take that program down a notch or result in a program that wasn't as, you know, beloved as it has been for so many years. What about that?
Well, it's a great question. And I think again, it's complicated. There was plenty bad said about Penn State program through the years. I mean, anytime players got in trouble or whatever, I mean, it was very big news. And Joe Paterno got himself in a lot of hot water through the years, either standing behind a player that he felt like had been wrongly accused, which happened actually right around the same time as the Sandusky incident, or cutting a player that he felt like just no longer deserved a chance. And there was plenty of bad publicity, you know, for Penn State and Penn State football. That said, there's no question that Penn State football was the pride of that university in many ways. Not the pride, but a pride for that university. Everybody was very, very proud of what Joe Paterno was doing. His graduation rates were off the charts high. He you know, was very, very adamant about never cheating the NCAA until this latest, you know, where they really came down hard, had never, you know, investigated Penn State and never looked at Penn State. So there was a lot of pride. They really felt like they were doing it the right way. Success with honor was the big saying around Penn State football. So there was a lot of pride in that. How much did people do to protect that image, fake, you know, in a behind-the-scenes way? Very, very difficult to say, but I think one thing that many, many, many academic people have come out and said, and of course, you probably saw recently a pretty big group of former you know, people that ran the university on the academic side really came down hard on the Free Report and the NCAA and felt like it was very unfair. And they were very, very clear in saying that at no point in their entire tenure did Joe Paterno or anybody from football try to sway them in any way.
You thought that Free Report, again, the former FBI director who came out and made some very hard allegations against Penn State, you thought that Free Report was incomplete at best. Why?
Well, they didn't talk to anybody involved.
Lots of people they didn't talk to.
Well, a lot of people. I challenge sometimes. People will ask me and I'll say, look, you can do the math yourself. Think of anybody you know who is involved in this. I mean, the names you've read in the paper. So you've read Mike McQuarrie. Tim Curley was the athletic director. You've read about him. He's going on trial in January. Gary Schultz was the vice president of business who the police reported to. He's going on trial in January. Joe Paterno, of course. Jerry Sandusky, of course. Tom Harmon was the police chief at the time. Karen Arnold was the working with the district attorney's office at the time that they closed the 1998 case, having nothing to do with Penn State, but that case was investigated by police and it was closed. It wasn't even closed. It was never brought to – they determined nothing wrong had happened. I just named seven people who are central. I mean, not
– And who were not talked to.
Were not talked to. Not a single one of those people were talked to. The only person that was really kind of involved in this case that was talked to was the former president, Graham Spanier, and – he has been adamant in saying that everything he said was ignored, that the report was written before they had talked to him. He's the most outspoken person so far against the Free Report, and he's the one person they talked to.
So what's the takeaway from that then? Why would Louis Free, who obviously is an accomplished man, miss so much and come out with a report that may have been cooked up prior to the investigation actually taking place?
Well, I would never put any kind of motive in him. I mean, that's as important as it is for me to be, you know, I'm trying to be as fair and down the middle as I possibly can. I just think it's obvious that they didn't talk to these people. Most of those people they didn't talk to because they couldn't talk to them. There's still court cases going on. The attorney general asked them not to speak to them. You know, so that's what we're talking about. I mean, it's not – I don't know that it was a purposeful effort to not talk to those people, but it was a purposeful effort to put out the report before talking to those people. I mean, those people can be talked to after January, I would imagine, and there was no waiting. I mean, the one thing that I find baffling about the Free Report, you know, and the Free Report did some great reporting and great work, and they did a lot of work. But one of the things people say about it all the time is they say the exhaustive Free Report. That's usually the word people put because they talked to 425 people and they talked to, you know, they looked at 3 million documents.
Yeah.
It can't be exhaustive if it doesn't talk to all the central characters. It can't be. But that's a strong word. When you use exhaustive, people see that and go, oh, boy, they uncovered every rock. And I mean, even I think the strongest Free Report defender could not say it's a complete report.
Again, Joe Posnanski, formerly of the Kansas City Star, is our guest. We're talking about his new book on Joe Paterno, and he speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For tickets, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. I'll give that number out again later, or you can just show up. And guess what, folks? Our phones are out today, but you can still get a hold of us for your questions for Joe and Joe Paterno. About Joe Paterno, our email address here, update@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, Joe, we were talking a few minutes ago about Paterno himself and this idea that he's a man from a different era. And you write early in the book that as he read the grand jury presentment for the first time, he looked up and he asked a question. And he asked, what does sodomy mean? And I just was taken so aback by that. Did he really not know?
It's one of the most powerful scenes of the book. And I was actually in St. Louis a couple of days ago, and I was doing a book signing. And after the signing, I mean, after I did a little talk, and then we did a signing. And after the signing, a couple came up to me, an older couple. They were probably in their 50s, I guess. And the woman said to me, look, I just want you to know, I appreciate you doing this book. I think you tried to do it very fair, but I don't believe it. I do not buy it that he would not know. He was a learned man. He had to know. It is impossible for me to believe that a man who had studied the classics, a man who had been to war and so on and so forth, wouldn't know. Her husband at that exact moment said, I totally disagree with that. I went to 12 years of Catholic seminary, and I know that these are the kinds of things you never talked about, and you might have heard the word, but that didn't mean you understood what it meant. And I totally believe he didn't know. And this is a husband and wife from, you know, and I thought, that's what I want as a writer. I want people to bring their own experiences. It doesn't matter, you know, I can interpret it just as well as they can interpret it. The thing that I would tell people about that is he said it in a private moment to his family. It's not like he said it with me there, or he said it with the cameras rolling, or he said it to try to prove a point.
So it has some legitimacy to it, perhaps.
It's something that, again, people would have to decide for themselves, but why would he do that to his own children? Why would he lie to them at that moment in that private setting? Why would he ask that question? I think people have to ask that for themselves.
You know, very late in his life, and I mean very late, he finally asked you what you thought. In fact, Joe, I think he actually asked you twice during that conversation. What did you say to him?
Well, he asked me, he said, what do you think about all this? And this was in the middle of a very, very emotional conversation. We were at his table in his kitchen.
Every big conversation.
Everything
had
always happened. That's where he had stared down the president to stay as head coach in 2004. That's where he had convinced hundreds of recruits to come play for him. So this was his office in many ways.
Yeah.
And we were at the table, and he was very, very sick, and he was coughing. And he said, what do you think about all this? And I thought that he meant, what do I think about the circus? I mean, the media and everything else. And there was, you know, people around his house. And I said, wow, you know, it's just, I've never seen anything like it. It's crazy. And he said, no, no, no. I mean, what do you think about all this? And, you know, I have lived this story, obviously, for a long time. I started writing this book long before the scandal. I got to know him long before the scandal. I talked to many, many people before the scandal. So I've lived this life, and I said to him, you're Joe Paterno, and you've always held people up to this incredibly high standard, and you've always held yourself up to that standard. And because of that, because you're Joe Paterno, you should have done more. And what I meant by that was exactly what you had said a few minutes ago. He should have followed up. This was obviously a very, very, no matter what he was told, this happened in the football locker room, his former coach. He needed to be sure that it was being taken care of and handled. And I said, you should have done more because you're Joe Paterno. And, he didn't say it, but he just kind of just nodded and said, I wish I had done more. And I kind of took from that was the regret he had, that he felt the same way, that it wasn't – he would never admit and would fight powerfully against all these people who believe he purposely covered this up, or that he tried to somehow manipulate things for his own legacy, which is just – if you read the book, you just realize how absurd that is.
And it's so absurd. Why, Joe?
He did things all the time that he thought were right, that were going to mess with his legacy. I mean, he just fought fights all the time that went against, as I say, in 2001, right around that time, there was a quarterback named Rashard Casey, who was not a very good quarterback. It turned out not to be very good. He was a big recruit, but he was their starting quarterback, and he was charged with a crime of beating up an undercover or off-duty police officer in a racial situation. It was a racial crime. And Rashard Casey went to Joe Paterno and said, it's not true. And he believed his player, and he played Rashard Casey, and he took tremendous abuse for it. I mean, just all sorts, everybody. Joe Paterno was a fraud. Joe Paterno never stood for anything right. Well, Rashard Casey was acquitted, and he sued the police department. He sued and won. I mean, he was clearly innocent of the charges. Now, sometimes that didn't have to be that way. He might have been found guilty, and Joe Paterno would have been found, But the point was, his legacy and the idea that he didn't want bad publicity, it just didn't match his personality. So I never bought that. I've never bought the idea of a cover up. But I also believe that Joe Paterno, if you hold everybody and yourself to such a high standard, you've got to come through in the biggest moments. And obviously, I don't know, by the way, if he had followed up or if he had done more, what would have been done. Like I say, in 1998, it went to police. And it went to child services, and they didn't do anything. So I'm not sure that he could have stopped it, but I know he wished he had done more.
Again, if you want to reach us this morning, our phones aren't working, but you can email us updatedate@kcur.org or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Just to be crystal, Joe, what did Joe Paterno do when it came to dealing with the information that he was given by Mike McQuarrie?
Right. Well, he was told something that morning. Very vague, as we've talked about what he was told.
Yeah,
he told me. Now, this is he what he said to the grand jury. He wasn't sure of certain things, and he became more sure of them when he talked to me. I don't know how that works with memory, but he said to me what he did was he's like, I don't know what to do about this. I don't know how to handle this. This is not my world. This is not my coach. He didn't work for him at the time, and he looked it up in the guidelines. What do I do here? And the guidelines said report it to the next person in the chain of command, which was athletic director Tim Curley.
Right.
And within a very short period of time, he told me it was that day. He told the grand jury he wasn't sure. It might have been – he might have not done it over the weekend. The consensus seems to be he did it the next morning. And he called him up and said, you guys need to get to the bottom of this.
And so he does that, and that's exactly what the rules required him to do. And – he walks away.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's pretty fair. I mean, that's certainly how his memory of it. Now, there are emails. There is an email specifically that suggests at some point Tim Curley came to him and talked to him about something along these lines. It's very difficult to tell what they talked about based on the email. The free report jumped. I wouldn't say jumped. They drew very, very harsh conclusions about that. They drew that they did follow up and that Joe Paterno at that point told them not to report this to child services. But I think that's one reading, and I think there are many, many readings you can make of that email. The point is that he didn't remember any sort of follow-up at all. And he was an old man, and it was 10 years ago.
Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with Joe Posnanski about his book on Joe Paterno. We'll turn to some of the withering criticism this book has endured and some other points in the book as well, and how Joe actually got access that he did to spend as much time as he did with Joe Paterno and his family. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation with political scientist Sam Popkin and on winning and holding the White House, you can find it and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow, look at Living the Artist's Life with Paul Durrell, jazz vocalist Kevin Mahogany, and Brian McTavish comes back with our weekend to-do list. This hour, we're visiting with Joe Posnanski about his new book on Joe Paterno. Joe will be speaking tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For tickets, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126, or just show up tonight. Now, this surely wasn't the book you envisioned doing when you got involved. Tell us about that. How did it change, and what was that like?
Well, it obviously changed a tremendous amount. You know, I started the process probably three years ago, a little more than 3 years ago now, and it was something that people around him really wanted me to do. His family and his friends really wanted me to do. And
you called them, I gather.
No, they called me.
Really?
Yeah, and thought it was something. You know, it was after I had written a piece about him for Sports Illustrated, and they really liked the piece, and really felt like nobody had ever sort of unlocked him, you know, in some way. We went back and forth a lot. I mean, not just with him, and Joe Paterno didn't want me to do this book for a long time, and then he sort of reluctantly agreed to allow me to do it, about a year before he died.
If he didn't want you to do it, why did the family call you to begin with?
Well, they thought he did. They kind of thought behind the scenes. I mean, Joe Paterno was a hard character, and he was grumpy, and especially toward the end, and they kind of felt like deep down he did want me to do it, and so they really kind of pushed me and pushed him, they're. His family, I mean, the people around him, I mean, they're just such good people, and they've taken so much abuse throughout all this, and now, of course, they're very much trying to in their minds, you know, right a wrong and clear his name, and believe wholeheartedly that he's been wildly misinterpreted through this whole thing, and they're taking a lot of abuse for that, you know, for standing up for their own family. I mean, this is a very, very emotional story for a lot of people.
And how well have they handled it? How have they handled it, Joe?
They've handled it. I mean, you know, obviously I'd be speaking a little bit for them, but from an outsider's view, they've handled it amazingly well, I think. I mean, you're talking about five kids and his wife, all of them having their own different kind of connection to Joe Paterno. I mean, you know, his son Jay coached for him in many ways. When this happened, he lost everything. I mean, he lost his father, he lost his best friend, he lost his boss, and he lost his job, essentially all in one short period of time. They all have had to deal with this and in many, many different ways, and I'm sure that it's left numerous, you know, marks and bruises and all that. But they've handled it well. They've gone on with life. Sue Paterno is still very, very involved in the charities and the community and all these sorts of things. And they've in many ways, they were at the first game. You know, Sue Paterno was at the first Penn State game. I mean, they're refusing to allow themselves to be consumed by bitterness. And I just have the greatest admiration for that.
You know, how long did it take Joe Paterno to warm up to you? Or did he ever?
You're assuming he did, yeah. You know what? We when I did the first story on him, we really connected in a certain way, and he was a tough character, but he was very smart, and he had a great memory, and he was a great storyteller, and so for a writer there was a lot there, and you know he respected. I believe he respected my honesty. People have asked me many times, did he ever put any kind of clamps or anything on this book? All he ever asked me to do was write the truth as best I could see it. That's all he ever asked me to do. And in the last months of his life, when all of this was going on, he we talked. I was over at his house, as we mentioned. I met him, you know, with him at the hospital. Those were the two really big conversations we had. He gave me his files, just gave them to me. I don't believe he even looked through them. He just gave me his files, and he said, "I want you to have everything, and I want you to tell the truth as best you can." And that's a big challenge. And of course, in the meantime, I'm getting hit pretty hard on all sides. So you try to live up to that.
You were getting hit even before the book came out.
Long before, yeah.
Because?
Good question. Because. Because this is a very, very emotional story. I mean, when Joe Paterno was fired, and that happened on a Wednesday night about 10 o'clock, and then there was this big campus thing.
With a very brief phone call between the head of the board and the coach himself.
Exactly. He was at the house. They sent a courier over. It was actually a longtime friend and coach of his with a piece of paper. And he looked at the piece of paper and said, "Call this number." He called that number. It was John Surma, who was the head of the board of trustees. And John Surma said, "You've been terminated." That was it.
And it was almost that brief of a conversation.
Yeah, this is John Surma. You've been terminated. I believe that's pretty much the entire conversation. And Joe Paterno hung up.
And Sue, his wife.
Sue called back. And said after 61 years.
How dare you?
Yeah, how dare you? After 61 years, how could you do this? So that happened. And, of course, the way it happened, it was the campus really, you know, exploded. I mean, people have seen some of the riot, whatever they, you know, call that scene. You know, we're turning over the truck and everything. But all over campus, there was just emotion just poured out. The next morning, I spoke at a class that was scheduled months earlier. I'd spoken to that class 3 or 4 years in a row. And I spoke to the class, and it was a very, very emotional conversation. And we talked about things. We talked about how fair it was. We talked about the media coverage. We talked about all these sorts of things. And some things were said, and I don't regret any of them. But they got tweeted out, and then they were – yeah, they were – some of them were things I didn't say. Some of those things were taken out of context. Some of them were things I said. And so people decided then that all I was interested in doing was defending Joe Paterno. And so I got hit hard, and it was rough. I'll tell you, I the thing that has really struck me about this is how, because I'm sure you'll talk about some of the criticism of the book. I think the book has been received 100 times better than I thought it would be. The criticism was much, much worse before the book came out. Now, a lot of those people who criticized the book before it came out just reiterated their criticisms in afterward. But the idea that I was a shill, the idea that I was a fraud, the idea that I, you know, those people, I have nothing to say. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. But the book, to me, has been received so openly in so many quarters. I've received so many emails. There have been so many positive reviews. There have been so many good things about this book. I didn't expect that, honestly. Yeah. I thought this was so emotional. That very few people were going to take the time and the effort to read the book and be honest and look at it through clear eyes, but many, many people have, and I'm very, very happy about that.
Well, let's turn to the criticism, Joe, because boy, some of it has been absolutely withering. Paul Campos at Salon.com, he's a critic, and he wrote this: "Paterno is a disgraceful book and a minor literary crime. To say Poznanski botches his journalistic and literary opportunity is akin to saying that the Titanic's maiden voyage might have gone more smoothly." And Jason Whitlock, your old running partner at The Star, called the book fluffy and shallow and concluded that you simply didn't know your subject.
They're entitled to their opinion, obviously. I could probably point to more reliable sources saying different things. The idea of all those people, and I'm certainly not going to talk about Jason, because that's a long-standing relationship there.
Well, what about that, though? People will wonder, because you two were so closely joined at the hip at The Star for so long, and here he is just taking the bark off your tree.
I don't think people have to wonder about it. I think they probably could figure it out.
Help me figure out what?
No, I am not going
okay.
there. Jason has entitled to his opinion, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
But, you know, look, people, and I've said this from the start, I said anybody who wants to read the book and come away with it thinking it's this or that or the other, that's what you do as an author, you know? It was before the book came out, when people were apparently in my head and knew exactly what I wanted to do or what I wanted to say or how I wanted to do it. Those are the people that I can't, you know, I mean, what am I going to say about those people? I mean, they're entitled to do that, but what's really left to say about that? So that was much, much harder. I mean, the book has come out, and as I've said, it's received some of the reviews, you know, that you've talked about. It's received many, many great reviews. It's received, here's how I'd like to sum it up. 1 month before the book came out, the New York Times, before they had read one word of the book, wrote a story about what a disaster it was going to be, how it was going to lose $1 million, how it was going to be, it's the worst timed biography that has ever come out. It was, you would talk about withering. This is before the book came out. The week that the book went to number one on the New York Times bestseller list, no story in the New York Times. and I just think that to me is, you know, it's odd for me to be in the middle of this kind of weird media thing. I've always been on the writing side of it, but I think that tells a lot.
Well, the timing of the book, why did it come out when it did? The original publication date was for about a year from now, roughly. Obviously, the publisher moved it up rather dramatically, I guess. What, to catch the tailwind of the controversy, Joe, or what drove it?
Well, he died. I mean, that's really what drove it. Okay. I mean, it was, you know, the idea of the book, I was supposed to deliver the book in August. That was when I was going to deliver it. And then whenever they published it, that was their decision. But then he died. And
In January
22nd, he died. And when he died, for me, now this is purely for me as an author, his words suddenly became, I thought, very important. They were very important for the conversation. The narrative of this story has been going one way, and nobody had heard from him. He'd given one interview to the Washington Post, and that was it. And he gave
right before he died, Sally Jenkins, I think. Yeah,
Sally Jenkins, and it was literally one day before he went to the hospital for the last time, and died, you know, 5-6 days later. So I thought it was really important, and. You know, the one thing that has kind of troubled me about everything has been not just that the narrative has gone in one direction, which is, you know, obviously troubling enough, but that any effort to bring any kind of dissent or any effort to sort of slow things down.
Or to put his life in context.
Or to put his life in context has been not dismissed, because dismissed would be, has been savagely beaten down. I mean, as I said, what the Paterno family have had to go through. You might remember Franco Harris, his former player, came out and tried to defend the coach and just took an incredible beating for it in the media, you know, and that has been where it's gone. And I don't agree with that. As a journalist, I don't agree with that. And in this particular case, I thought his voice should be heard in as timely a fashion as possible. They asked me if I could write the book 6 weeks earlier than I wrote it as a final. And then they put it out when they felt like it would be at its best. Like I said, we had many discussions about it, and there were many, many people who thought the timing was horrible commercially. I mean, as I said, the New York Times had them losing $1 million on this book. But they stuck with what they believed was the right thing to do, and I tried to write the book as best I could.
Why didn't you ask for more time to allow these events to sort of settle and allow yourself a little more latitude to put his life in context, maybe a step or two away from the furor that you confronted here with this thing?
Well, I think I have two answers for that, because the first answer I kind of just gave you. His death to me was the compelling factor. I just felt like I didn't want to wait a year or 2 years or 3 years to get these, you know, his thoughts on all of this out. I thought it was important, and I think it should be part of the conversation. You don't have to believe him. You don't have to agree with him. You might think he's a complete liar and all that, but his voice deserves to be heard in this conversation. That's the first thing. The second thing is I've been and you know, we've known each other a while, and you know how much I respect you. I've been asked that question a lot. Why did you not? Why did you put it out now? Why did you put it out now? Nobody asked that of the Free Report. Mm-hmm. Nobody's asked that of the hundreds and hundreds of columnists that have attacked him and destroyed him and ripped into him. Nobody said, hey, why don't you wait? January, there's going to be another trial. Why don't you wait for that? Nobody's waited, you know? And it seems like the only person that gets asked that question is the person trying at best I can to write as honest and contextual a story as I can write. I think it's important to be in there. I think it's important. Yeah. I had many questions myself about the timing, but now that it's out and now that I see where it is in the argument, and I see how strongly people are responding to it, I think we did the right thing.
Our phones are out today. You can reach us by emailing us updatedate@kcur.org. You can go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Becca tweets this: nothing Paterno did matters in life if he failed to protect children. I can't admire his coaching style knowing he's a monster. And she wants to know, will time ever balance his feats as a coach with the scandal? Do you foresee that day coming?
I think we have to find out if he's a monster. I mean, I think that's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, the monster here is Jerry Sandusky. And what Jerry Sandusky did, the good things in life, nobody's trying to balance that out.
Yeah.
The question is, what did Joe Paterno do? What did he know? And those are questions that he talks about at length in the book. Those are questions, as I said, that are going to come out. I do think as people move away from this emotionally, they're going to see a clearer picture, obviously. You know, one of the things I use in the book is a quote from the Oxbow incident, which I said, you know, justice is never obtained through haste or harsh feelings or strong feelings. And I think that's true. I mean, you know, it's difficult now to know what it's going to be like in 5 years, you know, what the legacy is going to be like.
Do you think we'll ever know more than we do now about what Joe knew and when he knew it?
I think we'll be told things, whether we believe them or not. I don't know. I think January's trial is going to be very, very interesting. I mean, this is the person who wrote the emails that have been used. He has not spoken on the subject, and I've been told by pretty reliable sources that he's going to say that the narrative that's out there is wrong and that Joe Paterno had nothing to do with any investigation, that Joe Paterno was not involved, that Joe Paterno did what he was supposed to do, and that's what he's going to say. Now, are people going to believe that? That's going to be interesting.
Dan in Brookside emailed us this. One of the first interviews I saw when the Sandusky story broke was with Barry Switzer on SportsCenter, I believe. He said that in a big-time college football program with all its coaches, assistants, administrators, student helpers, and players, there is no way that the behavior of Sandusky over the years wouldn't have been known. Could everybody at Penn State really have been so blind?
Well, I don't think we're talking about everybody at Penn State. But I will say this about Barry Switzer. A former assistant coach of his worked at Penn State at the time.
Yeah.
And he called up Barry Switzer and said, Barry, I worked for you for 10 years. I didn't realize all these things you were doing in your private life. And I thought – and Barry Switzer kind of backed down because there are things in Barry Switzer's private life he would probably prefer not being known. And I'm not saying anything about Barry Switzer. I mean, you know, I'm not saying anything criminal.
But did Sandusky have a reputation during the 90s for this kind of thing or not?
Certainly nobody said that he did, you know?
I mean, it wasn't like it was whispered around town.
Well, here's again, I mean, this is a question. Media came in all the time. There was media in State College. I mean, there's media around the Penn State. I mean, this was not an uncovered program. Not a single word was ever written in those things. Nothing ever leaked to anybody in the media for 15 years, 10 years. Yeah. I mean, but it sounds like I'm just saying that nobody was responsible here. Horrible, horrible crimes were committed, and a lot of people should have and do have regrets that they didn't do more, that they didn't put two and two together, that they didn't see it, that they didn't try to stop it in some way, some shape or form. I'm not in any way suggesting that, but I am saying that one of the things that is very easy to do, I think, is in retrospect, look back and say, oh, how could you have missed this?
Mm-hmm.
We are missing these kinds of crimes all over the country. Jerry Sandusky's not the only one. They're in communities all over the country. And I think it's very, very easy to say, oh, I would have known, I would have done this, I would have done that. The statistics don't back that.
I'm being told now that our phones, in fact, might be up. Let's give it a whirl. 816-235-2888. We got about 7 minutes left in this hour. Again, 816-235-2888 if you have a question for Joe Posnanski. You know, I got to tell you, Joe, the Paterno himself comes across to me as something of an enigma in this book. And I'm wondering what made him the coach of such renown that he was. Because here's a guy who doesn't recall his players' names in so many cases, who's calling them things like the stupidest player I ever coached. That's Tamba Ali of the Chiefs, as a matter of fact. He fought openly in front of his players with Jerry Sandusky, sort of like my sense of Mike Ditka and Buddy Ryan back in the days with the Chicago Bears. He repeats these coaching cliches over and over again, like run to the ball, which my high school coach still rings in my ear to this day. So what made him the great coach that he apparently was?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody would question he was a great coach. I mean, there are a lot of things. Again, it's not one simple thing. I mean, he prepared more than everybody else. I mean, he worked harder at it than everybody else. He stayed true to those cliches that you're talking about.
Those guiding principles.
He stayed true to those all the time.
Victory with honor and all that. Yeah.
Victory with honor, but also run to the ball and always hustle. And you know if you hustle, something good will happen. And these are cliches, but if you just hammer them into people, they work. I mean, they certainly work on football. He was a great recruiter. He convinced the players to play that they were playing for something larger than themselves. That's what great coaches do, and they do it in many, many different ways. And Joe Paterno was nothing like Bear Bryant, and Bear Bryant's nothing like Nick Saban, and Nick Saban's nothing like Vince Lombardi. Yeah. But they all did it in very, very different ways. And you know, you look at 50 years of Joe Paterno coaching. His way worked,
and yet it really wasn't very flashy. And in today's culture, flashy certainly sells. Is that what sort of holds him back from, even though he was so successful, having a higher level of regard in our culture today? Because his uniforms were dull, his players were dull, it was all for the team first, and that doesn't seem very sexy these days.
Well, it doesn't, but I would say it would be harder for him to have gotten a higher regard, you know, in his time. And he was Sportsman of the Year, he was 2 national championships, he was St. Joe, he was all these things, had several books written about him. I mean, he was very, very well known. I think that was part of his secret too, was being plain. That was his fight against society. It's like, we are going to come here and you're going to put on these ugly uniforms with your names not going to be in the back, helmets that are just white with a blue stripe down. We're going to graduate. Yeah. We're not going to cheat. We're going to do everything the right way. And that was part of how he got his players to believe that they were playing for something larger than themselves.
Let's go to some phone calls now. We just have a few minutes left. Kathy from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on with Joe Posnanski. Good morning, Kathy. You there, Kathy? I guess not. Maybe our phones aren't up to date here. He was extraordinarily generous to Penn State over the years. No question about that.
Nobody argues that. Yeah, I mean, he and his wife essentially built the library on campus. They gave millions of dollars to the school. They you know, were very, very involved in charitable events. I mean, they loved Penn State. Nobody would argue that point. They loved it. They stayed there when it would have been very, very lucrative for them to leave. He did love Penn State and believed in education. And no matter what you may believe about him, and you know, we had the one person tweet saying nothing he could have done in life could have overshadowed that. I'm not arguing that point, but you can't say that didn't happen.
Yeah.
You can't just say, you know, it was irrelevant. I mean, you could say it doesn't outweigh it. We can have that argument all day, but you can't say it didn't happen. This is a man who stayed the same house, same campus, right by the campus, built the library. They built a religious center. They built they were the driving forces behind so many things that happened at Penn State University. And that's why they loved him.
Yeah. Let's try this call. Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, are you there?
Yeah, so just real quickly, I want to support the author and what he's doing. I don't know all the details of what's occurred. I've kind of followed it. But what really irritates me in this country is people are quick to judge and jump to conclusions without looking in the mirror first. So before people pass judgment on this gentleman, they really should find out the facts, and they don't have the facts. And I want to applaud his courage in standing up and telling the facts as he knows them. And stick to your guns, please. We need more people like you, please.
Chris, I appreciate that. And before we go, Joe, the news just broke the other day that Al Pacino may be playing Joe Paterno in a new movie based on your book. Is that really going to happen?
I have no idea. It's been funny. You know, it's...
Who would have thought?
Well, this happened on Friday, I guess. The story broke. I was told a few weeks ago that Al Pacino had read the book, even before it came out. And loved it and wanted to play Paterno. And I'd heard that, and I knew that there was some talk of him attaching it and him trying to pitch it and all that. But then it leaked out, I guess, on Friday, and I was at home with my kids and my wife, and we were watching a movie, and my mother called to scream, oh, my gosh, is Al Pacino really going to play this movie? And my wife said, you know, that all she cares about is do we get to meet Al Pacino. So I know literally less than everybody else knows about this, but it is interesting.
Just quickly, Joe, you left the star for your dream job writing for Sports Illustrated, but you were there just for a couple of years. You've now left to take a position with Sports on Earth. What on earth is Sports on Earth?
It's a brand new website. I mean, brand new. We're up 2 weeks now, 3 weeks. That is a joint venture, as you mentioned, of USA Today and the internet arm of MLB, the technology arm, I guess. Yeah. And it's a website built around great sports writing. That's the idea. We've hired some, I believe, really great sports writers. We're going to try to be sort of a daily magazine about sports, you know, and it's really cool. It's up. It's running.
And the website is?
SportsOnEarth.com, so okay. It's as easy to remember as anything.
Joe, it's been a pleasure to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, all the best. Again, folks can see and hear Joe Posnanski tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. It very well could be crowded. For tickets, you might want to hustle. Call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126, or you can just take a chance and show up tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Tomorrow on the show, Living the Artist's Life with Paul Durrell, jazz vocalist Kevin Mahogany, and Brian McTavish with our weekend to-do list. Today's show was produced by Danny Alexander. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.